Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the strategic position that Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire found themselves in the summer and autumn of 1914. So today I'm looking at Ring of Steel by Alexander Watson, which, if you haven't already read it, is one of the best modern accounts of the war from a Germanocentric point of view. Too often I feel the First World War is told to us as a story of primarily the British on the Western Front, and the Germanic worldview during the First World War is fundamentally different, obviously, and tells us a different and no less relevant story. So there is a huge strategic problem in the summer of 1914, and it is the problem that Bismarck had tried to avoid since 1871 to 1890, and that was the development of a two-front war. Germany was at its best when it was able to fight a war on one front. The German army reorganised, the Prussian army, shall we say, throughout the 1840s, 50s and 60s, was the best organised and best led fighting force in Europe, defeating the French in 1871. But Bismarck was well aware that the problem that Germany would always face is that it is a Central European power, easily surrounded. And Bismarck's policy of isolating France from either Russia or Austria-Hungary had only a certain lifespan. And the alliance system, the Dreikaiserbund, and then the dual alliance, and then the triple alliance that Bismarck created after 1871, meant that for as long as possible, France might be isolated and that France might not find an ally in the East. But by the 1890s, having seen the diplomatic position, the diplomatic network that Bismarck created gradually unravel, and it had begun to unravel before Bismarck's dismissal in 1890 anyway, it was only accelerated by this process. A realignment sees Germany with the German Empire and its only ally, the Austrian Empire, surrounded by a hostile Russia in the east and a hostile France in the west. So here begins the strategic problem that Bismarck had always sought to avoid, the war on two fronts. A war of attrition, it would ultimately wind up being. The German Empire can fight lightning wars, quick wars, very successfully. Wars of attrition, not so much. So, Alexander Watson writes, "The German and Habsburg general staffs confronted a strategic nightmare in the summer of 1914. Each faced a war on two fronts. To To Germany's west stood the modern French, Belgian and British armies. Opposite Austria-Hungary's southeastern border were the battle-hardened Serbian and Montenegrin troops. And in the east, over both, loomed the mighty Russian military. Together these enemies fielded 5,726,000 soldiers, organised into 218 infantry and 49 cavalry divisions. Against them, the Central Powers had just 3,485,000 men in 137 infantry and 22 cavalry divisions. German and Austro-Hungarian generals knew that if victory were to be won, despite their forces' numerical inferiority, it would have to be quickly, for the odds against them would only lengthen in a prolonged conflict. France and Russia's combined gross domestic product exceeded that of the Central Powers by one-fifth, and the Tsarist Empire's population alone outnumbered their inhabitants by one-third. Moreover, German military planners had assumed since 1908 that Britain would inevitably, if not immediately, enter hostilities and place its enormous financial and naval resources at the Entente's disposal. Here there were sound domestic reasons to fear a long conflict. Habsburg leaders, already anxious about their people's loyalties in peace, could scarcely welcome the destabilising hardship and discontents that would accompany extended hostilities. Alfred Graf von Schlieffen, the chief of the Prussian General Staff from 1891 to 1905, had predicted that any drawn-out war would bring economic ruin and quite probably revolution. So in that last part of the passage from Alexander Watson there, the statement ascribed to Schlieffen, the deviser of the Schlieffen Plan, to have a lightning attack in the west against France, to seize Paris very quickly, and then to mobilise against a much slower Russia. That plan by 1914 was already nearly a decade out of date and did not take into account the fact that Russian mobilisation times had dramatically improved because of the development of railways in Russia, and that France might put up more of a fight than expected, thus slowing down the advances on the Western Front, which is ultimately what happens. So the Schlieffen Plan isn't fit for purpose in 1914. But what Schlieffen was predicting about revolution is entirely prescient. Schlieffen, in his statement, argued that the massive financial costs of the war would bring both empires to their knees and push them close to kind of revolutionary disturbances, which is ultimately what happens in the cases of both Austro-Hungary and in the case of the German Empire. And of course it happened in Russia a year before the war ended. And there were revolutionary disturbances in the French army and significant disturbances, whether they were of a revolutionary nature or not, but significant unrest on the home front in Great Britain and also in America. So in a way, all combatant powers were trying to outrun revolution by the last couple of years of the war. And the other significant factor in that passage from Watson is the idea that Austria-Hungary was concerned about war because of its fissile nature, the fact that it is likely to break apart, as it already has significant nationalist pressures from Czechs, Croats, Bosnians, Italians and others, and that it might well fragment entirely under the pressure of war. So what this meant was that in 1914, absolute annihilation of the enemy becomes imperative. Why? Because the war has to be won quickly. The ruthless battlefield tactics and the ruthless attitude as well that was written into German military law about dealing with fifth columnists, partisans and potential revolutionaries reflected not only the speed with which Germany had to win the war, but also German and Austrian anxieties about revolution. Given the fact that in the summer of 1914, the Kaiser famously offered the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg crown the blank cheque, the idea that no matter what Austria did, Germany would support it. And the fact that the Kaiser did this because if Austria were to be defeated, then Germany would really be abandoned, isolated and alone, surrounded by hostile enemies. It seems curious that there was, in the run-up to the war, in the decade run-up to the war, there was very little collaboration or communication between the general staffs of both armies. When, in the case of Schlieffen, who was highly secretive about his plans and really quite dismissive about the abilities of the Austro-Hungarians to fight, he made sure that there was limited contact between the chiefs of the general staffs of both armies, which are really limited to pleasantries and, as Watson points out, just simply to Christmas cards, which seems a bit absurd but true. When Helmut von Moltke and Franz Conrad von Hotzendorf became the heads of the chiefs of staff of the German and Austrian armies, respectively, during 1906, things began to change. This was added to by the tensions that were sparked by the Bosnian crisis in 1908, and both chiefs of staff realised that they had to communicate with one another and they would need to rely on one another in the future. However, neither the Austro-Hungarian nor the German government's political or monarchical at the political or monarchical levels, had any real interest in further collaboration. So it became more of a private affair between Helmut von Moltke and Franz Conrad von Hotzendorf. So, for example, in 1909, the Austro-Hungarians were told that in a two-front war, the Germans would deploy the majority of their forces immediately in the west, and therefore Moltke would need the Austrians to launch an offensive against the Russians in order to distract them from the weaker eastern border of Germany, while the German army defeated France. So, in order to reassure Austria, Moltke promised Conrad that that whatever small forces that were left would attack in order to draw off as many enemy soldiers away from Austria as possible. The Habsburg chief of the general staff, when hearing this, saw the prospect of taking on most of the Tsarist army but in 1914, highly daunting. There is no question the fact that alone Austria faced very little chance against the might of Russia. And from 1909 onwards, when these conversations were being transmitted, the Moltke sort of pledge seemed highly unrealistic. This became more so, more acute in the 5 years that followed as Russia rapidly rearmed and modernised and a kind of a militarised industrial revolution, particularly with the militarised use of railways, was...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Underway. And this meant that deployment plans became increasingly redundant. Conrad did not demand too much from Moltke for a more kind of detailed commitment. When a German victory in the West was possible, or if and when a German victory in the West happened, and that would be accompanied by a defensive action by the Habsburg armies, keeping the Russians out, then it was loosely assured to the Austrians the German army would be transferred eastwards, and that would enable the Central Powers together to overwhelm Russia. And this was the only assurance that Conrad sought. And it meant that Conrad, knowing this, knowing basically what the Schlieffen plan said, felt fairly comfortable to place his forces in the in a way in which a confrontation with Serbia could happen. The protector of Serbia obviously being the Russian Empire. And this seems to be the thing that is foremost in the minds of the Austrian chiefs of general staff, was that with Germany around, there is an opportunity to do something about the Serbs. Perhaps it was never quite believed that Austria would come to blows with Russia anyway, but it was certainly presumed that the Serbs, the great thorn in Austria's side, would need to be dealt with somehow or other. And perhaps what Germany represented at its best, as far as the Austrians were concerned, was an insurance policy that would keep the Russians at bay and keep the Russians from meddling in what the Austrians believed to be Austrian Balkan affairs. Alexander Watson writes, "The German campaign plan for the Western Front was the keystone of the Central Powers strategy in 1914. Moltke was broadly correct when he told Conrad in February 1913 that Austria's fate will not be decided definitively along the Bug, the central river in Poland, but rather along the Seine in France. His aim was to turn encirclement to advantage, concentrate his forces overwhelmingly against France, and then, once that enemy was eliminated, use the Reich's efficient railway system to transport them eastwards. Time was critical. If the Western campaign took longer than 6 weeks, the slow but powerful Russian army would be able to mobilise fully, giving it the opportunity to overwhelm the Austro-Hungarians in Galicia and to weaken German and the weak German force left in East Prussia. The German chief of staff's key challenge was thus to defeat France quickly. German officers in the war's aftermath claimed that the answer to this problem was bequeathed to Moltke in a memorandum written in 1905-6 by his illustrious predecessor, the infamous Schlieffen Plan. This plan envisaged an army of 96 infantry divisions, 82 of which, later joined by 5 others from the south, were to be deployed as a strong right wing between the Metz and Aachen, and tasked with sweeping through the Benelux countries in order to bypass France's chain of border fortresses and break up its northeastern break into its northeast. The point of Schlieffen's plan was not, contrary to an oft-repeated claim, to capture Paris, a highly undesirable last resort necessarily, only if the enemy retreated so far that his left flank rested on the fortified city. Instead, the plan's primary objective was the envelopment, where that might prove possible, and through it, the annihilation of France's army. So the key objective of the Schlieffen plan was to surround France's armies and destroy them. Part of the Schlieffen plan, coming through Belgium and the Netherlands, was also to seize the five main channel ports, and in doing so, cut off the British, the British who were going to arrive. We tried to do it quickly before British troops landed, or those that had arrived, to cut them off from reinforcements. So despite the fact that Moltke paid more attention, by and large, to German-Austrian relations, he was still hugely influenced by the Schlieffen Memorandum, or the Schlieffen Plan. And he saw the strong right wing of the German army carving through Belgium and outflanking the French fortresses as the key objective of the campaign on the Western Front. And also the policy of envelopment and encirclement. And this paints a picture of the German army, as Moltke envisaged it, engaged in a dramatic war of movement, a very, very quick war, not the stalemate war of position that the German army winds up in 1914. Alexander Watson writes, "Moltke worked in far less favourable circumstances. He was confronted not only with a two-front war, which necessitated leaving nine divisions in the east, but also with a Western enemy likely to fight more aggressively than 10 years earlier. He was also pessimistic, or rather more realistic, about many of the assumptions built into the Schlieffen plan. Consequently, he introduced important modifications, most notably, and against his predecessor's legendary deathbed exhortation to keep the right wing strong, he weakened it. Whereas Schlieffen placed 87 divisions here, Moltke only had 54. The ratio of forces between the left and the right wings was also changed, from 1 in 7 in the original 1906 plan to 1 in 3 in 1914. To Moltke's post-war denigrators, this was a disastrous decision that cost Germany its chance of an early victory. In actuality, it made a lot of sense. Moltke needed fewer divisions on the right because, unlike Schlieffen, he neither intended his troops to march through the Dutch as well as Belgian territory, nor in any circumstances to march around Paris. Taking on Holland, he recognised, would absorb considerable strength better deployed against Germany's real enemies. Moreover, Moltke knew his plan was already a high-risk enterprise. He wanted insurance and hoped that if the initial offensive failed and a static war developed, a neutral Holland might act as a windpipe through which the blockaded Reich could funnel goods and raw materials." So this is a clue about Moltke's pessimism. He rightly predicted that fierce resistance from France and also assistance from Britain might wind up leaving the Reich blockaded, as it did become, and so trying to use the Netherlands as a route for goods and materials into Germany was an important part of the strategy. Not that the Netherlands really becomes that. However, the other part of the kind of the more pessimistic view that Moltke had, the more defensive-based view that Moltke had, was that the Saar, the industrial heartland of Western Germany, needed to be protected, and that the troops that he didn't spend on the right wing march through the Benelux countries could be moved to the left wing of the German Western attack, and 16 divisions could be used in order to protect the Tsar. This was based on the assumption that the war would not be won quickly. Again, part of Moltke's more pessimistic outlook, his assumption that the war might well drag on and precautions needed to be taken as a result. Many of the assumptions of the German army had been based on the disaster of the French army in 1870 in the Franco-Prussian War, where incompetent generals, poorly led soldiers, old equipment, and a sort of archaic internal communication system within the French army led to its rapid defeat. It was assumed by the German army that the same thing could be possible in 1914. Within 6 weeks, once again, the French army could be surrounded and defeated. However, this is a very different French army that the Germans are dealing with. This was a wildly ambitious, not to say highly reckless, plan that had very little chance within a six-week period of actually succeeding. And when the French and the British hold the line at the Battle of the Marne, the German War of Encirclement ends. And because the German War of Encirclement ends after just a few weeks, it means that the Germans and the Austrians are only capable of fighting a war of position from then onwards. Being able to rapidly move troops across the battlefield, carry out encirclements and the destruction of enemy armies at the pace at which Germany wanted, at the pace at which that would ensure a German victory, becomes impossible. And from that moment on, the clock is ticking for Germany's defeat. Germany fights a number of offensives in 1915, 16, and 17, and finally the Ludendorff offensive in 1918. But with each offensive, Germany isn't able to land a knockout blow and expends that what is left of its own energies in trying to do this, and brings itself and its ally Austria that much closer to total economic and political exhaustion and ultimately defeat. And it is defeat that comes in the guise of revolution. Germany's own working classes and soldiers are the ones that finally end the war. Okay, so thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. If you can support us by Patreon, that's very gratefully received. Check out our Explaining History Patreon page. Because we do rely on advertising revenue, which ain't very much, and the generosity of funders. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.